We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we're talking about the 2008 election. Now, one of the interesting things that's come out is the claim about what the election means. Now, let's just go back and remember a little bit of history here. It turns out that in 2004, when George W. Bush won over John Kerry, people called it a mandate. Keep in mind the election with Gore had been essentially tied in electoral votes until Florida was decided. It gave it narrowly to Bush. And, of course, Gore beat Bush in the popular vote by, I don't know, 500,000 votes or something. Well, Bush beat Gore. I'm sorry, Bush beat Kerry by 3.3 million votes. All right? And he got 286 electoral votes. Right? And I think he won by like 3 percentage points, 52 to 49%. Right? Well, the media were all out there calling this a mandate. And I'm not talking the right-wing media exclusively. Several commentators on CNN, several in CBS, National Public Radio, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, basically claimed that Bush now had a mandate with this 3% win. And, of course, the Bush administration had been governing as though they had a mandate from the beginning. Right? Bush won narrowly, but instead of governing from the center, he and Cheney and the crew decided, look, we won the election. You go all out. You go for your position. You go to get get as much as you can of the pie, get what you want out of it. And that's what he did. And that's one of the reasons why the country didn't follow him and wasn't behind him. And a big reason why the Iraq War, he ends up owning that, and the country didn't stay behind it, is that they didn't really sign up for it in the first place. He bullied the U.S. into that war. And we've covered this before. But what's interesting now is that in the wake of the Obama win, all these pundits, a lot of the same ones, are making the argument that, A, this is a center-right country still, and so this is not a call for a move to the left. B, that people were voting for, not for Obama, but against Bush, and so Democrats shouldn't read too much into this, and neither should Obama. And C, that if you want to hang on to the votes in the center and the swing votes, you don't want to alienate them, so you don't want to govern from the left. Well, what's interesting about that is that when Bush wins, a 3% win is enough to say he has a mandate to govern from the right. But when Obama wins, and he wins by 6 percentage points, it's not enough to say he has a mandate to govern from the left. I mean, that's really interesting. It's also interesting when you think about the electoral votes. Bush had 286 electoral votes. Remember, you need 270 to win. Obama has over 350 electoral votes. Or no, maybe he ended up at 349. I didn't even look at the final total because I don't think he won Missouri. I don't think they've awarded Missouri yet. That's the problem. We don't have a final total yet. In any case, this is, in terms of electoral votes, this is in the area of a landslide for Obama. He took 9 states back that Bush had won in one of the last two elections, and actually 7 states that Bush won in both elections in 2000 and 2004. Made inroads in 3 areas of the country. In the South, he got Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. Some people say Florida's not the South anymore because of all the snowbirds. In the Midwest, he got Iowa, which Bush only carried one of the two elections, and it does go back and forth. He got New Mexico, which goes back and forth. It has, at least, in the last two elections. I think Gore carried it. And he got Colorado, which has been fairly Republican until recently. And then he took New Hampshire, which Bush had split, only took one of his two elections. And I'm trying to think what the other states are. The point is that Obama has engineered an electoral victory even more interesting than the victories Bill Clinton was able to engineer. Of course, he was a Southerner, so he was able to take states like Arkansas, pick up a couple of other Southern states. But the pundits are out there saying this does not entail a mandate. This does not give him a mandate. It's just really interesting, and they make the claim that it's still a center-right country. Now, I get why Bill Kristol makes that case, and he did in an editorial in the New York Times, and why Rush Limbaugh makes that case, and all of that. What I don't get is why regular news people make that case, because let's look at the list of issues. Obama said that he would get us out of Iraq and go after Afghanistan and bin Laden. Well, getting us out of Iraq is hardly a conservative position as those have been laid down in recent years. He was on tax policy. He was going to let the Bush tax cuts expire. In fact, he probably was saying he'd repeal them. Basically, he's raising the marginal rates back to where they were in the Clinton years. That's repealing them, or with the economic meltdown, he'll probably just let them expire now instead of repealing. They will expire by 2011. But, I mean, that's a liberal policy. It's not socialism, as everybody was trying to scream before the election, but it's a liberal policy. On health care, he wants essentially universal coverage, and he's promised to close Guantanamo Bay and said we will not, the world will know that we don't torture anymore. I mean, those are all anything but Republican/conservative positions. The Republicans were all over all those issues, and he had a few others, but the point is, he ran as a liberal. I mean, he had tax cuts so that you could say, well, that's center, or that's a Republican issue. But in fact, that's the way Democrats have to defend themselves against the Republican pandering. You know, I was listening to somebody today. It was probably Michael Savage on the way in. Don't ask me why. But he was making the case that, well, the reason Obama won, the reason people vote for Democrats is they promise you anything. They'll give you anything you want. You know, they're giving away free stuff, so all these saps vote for them. I beg your pardon. Let's stop and think about this. Who panders more? The Republican mantra since Reagan has been tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. Not spending cuts. They say they're going to do that, but that's not what they promised during elections, and they never identify any spending cuts. They say tax cuts. I'm sorry. Tax cuts are the easiest thing in the world to promise voters. You're basically saying, we're going to give you money back. No pain, no harm. Don't worry about it. We're not going to take anything else away because they don't tell you what they'll take away. If the Democrats are tax and spend, as Republicans have tried to paint them for the better part of 40 years, then Republicans are the party of borrow and spend. They aren't willing to pay for what they spend, because they pushed the deficits up in the 80s, they pushed the deficits up in the 2000s. Reagan pushed the deficits up, Bush pushed the deficits up. When Reagan ran, we said, well, wait a minute, you can't have tax cuts, balance the budget, and have increases in military spending. You won't be able to balance the budget. And Reagan said, no, you don't understand. I've got this Laffer curve here, this supply-side economics. And what it shows is that the more you cut taxes, the more revenue you generate for the Treasury. And people were like, okay, how does that work? And he said, well, you get increases in the size of the economy. And the country bought it in 1980 and said, okay, let's see how this works. Well, it didn't work. By 85, Reagan was pursuing tax increases of his own, and the budget deficits ballooned during the Reagan years and right into the Bush years. Clinton raised taxes and couldn't get one Republican vote to do it. He ended up needing Al Gore, I think it was, to do the tiebreaker in the Senate. They pushed through a package of tax increases, and the Republicans warned, oh, the economy will tank, you're crazy. This very simplistic, if you increase taxes, it hurts the economy. If you decrease taxes, it helps the economy. And what happened? It was partly that Clinton got lucky and we had the boom of the internet, but tax revenues went up so much and the economy grew so much in the 90s that the deficit went away and we started running surpluses. Bush comes in, and he's got a $2.6 trillion surplus on paper that's supposed to come over the next 10 years. And he says, to quote him indirectly, it's your money. You paid for it. So he wants to give it back as tax cuts. So he gave back $2.3 trillion, which never showed up anyway, meaning those projections were off. $2.3 trillion in tax cuts over 10 years, intentionally had them expire. In 2010 and 2011, because there just wouldn't, it just busted the bank when you looked at the economic models if he'd made them permanent, because they end up adding and adding and adding hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars. So they had them sunsetted, expired, figuring, well, we got time to change this later. We'll accuse anybody that wants to let them expire of being in favor of tax increases. And of course, that's what they did with Obama. Now, what's interesting here, too, is that the Bush tax cuts, the ostensible purpose in the beginning, if you recall, in 1999, was that the government's collecting too much of your money. They shouldn't be doing that. They should be giving it back. Now, you could ask yourself, why didn't he apply that logic to payroll taxes? The poor, everyone pays payroll taxes, even if they don't pay income taxes, and it takes a chunk out of our salaries. All right? People that get their living off of capital gains taxes, interest and dividend don't pay that. But the poor pay it, certainly, in the middle class. And the people say, oh, no, well, Social Security, that goes in a special fund. I think there's a lockbox of some sort, if I remember right from the 2000 campaign. No, it goes into the general fund. We've been writing IOUs against the Social Security money and using a couple hundred billion a year from that, the surplus from that, in the general fund to keep the deficit looking like it's lower. But we're running up these huge trillions of dollars in Social Security entitlement obligations and not worry about paying those back. But so Bush cuts tax rates, which means it advantages the well-to-do more than the poor and lower middle class and middle class. And he says after we had a recession in just about the time he's coming into office, he changed his rationale and said, well, when I'm not giving the money back now because we're taxing too much and you deserve it, we're going to do this to stimulate the economy. Well, as I've said before on this show, you don't need $2.3 trillion to stimulate the economy. We used to stimulate the economy with between 100 and 200 billion, maybe less in the old days. So, granted, he did that. So he's saying we'll get growth and we'll end up with more revenue than ever. Funny thing happened on the way to this. We are now at the peak of the Bush tax cuts. Remember, these were backloaded. They didn't really do much in the first 5 years, which is why the idea that they were going to be a stimulus for the economy during the recession of 2001 and two didn't make any sense at all, but people allowed him to do what he wanted. Now we're seeing the bulk of those $2.3 trillion in tax cuts going into effect right now. It should be the ultimate stimulus package planned years in advance, and yet the economy's tanked. So please, please, please don't take economic advice from Republicans who argue, oh, you can't raise taxes at this time, and you must cut taxes, and it will increase revenue, and it's been shown that when you decrease the capital gains tax, it actually increases the revenue. That's not true. It does not show that. You actually lose revenue. If you cut the tax rates, capital gains or marginal income tax rates, you cut the revenue coming in, period. This counterintuitive notion that supposedly was going to come with supply-side economics and trickle-down economics, it's just flat-out wrong. It's been proven to be wrong by economists, and yet conservative pundits repeat it, radio talk show hosts on the right repeat it, and they've got mainstream media repeating it. And it's simply not true. Okay, when we move on here, I guess I got to say one more thing before we take our break, and that is Brent Bozell. So this is interesting because Bozell has been, I saw him on Fox News last week, and he was saying that Obama ran as a Reaganite and a fiscal conservative, tax cuts, don't you know, so that this is not an endorsement of liberal policies, and he shouldn't govern from the left, and he shouldn't try and take the country to the left we're still a center-right country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if I hadn't seen Brent Bozell just 1 week earlier on the same network, Fox News, claiming that Obama was interested in socialism because he was going to, quote, redistribute the wealth, I wouldn't have believed he could do a flip-flop like this in 1 day or 1 week, but he did. In any case, when we come back, we're going to move on to another topic, and that will be the way that conservatives are dealing with the various announcements that come out from the campaign. For example, what I mean by that is the announcement of Rahm Emanuel. The Andy Finn Show will be right back.
Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. Insists he and Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people. Where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter, writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near? Look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foe. Is it for show? All the right-wing parrots, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Ah, look at all the angry people. Ah, look at all the angry people. Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates right-wing judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is November 17th. It is the birthday of several people, not all of whom are alive anymore, but Danny DeVito. These people were all born on the same day in the same year, November 17th. Danny DeVito, Tom Seaver, the Hall of Fame pitcher from the New York Mets originally, Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live fame, and Lauren Hutton. So think about that. What year would the four of them been born? What age are those folks? Well, if you guessed they're 64 years old, that's correct, which means they were born in 1944, the second last year of World War II. And it was on this day in, well, I won't give you the year yet. This was the date. November 17th was the date of the infamous Heidi game. Now, if you don't know this story, if you're an NFL fan, you probably know the story. But the Heidi game happened on a Sunday afternoon when a New York Jets-Oakland Raiders game was scheduled. And, of course, in 1968, this was AFC... Was it AFC stuff? No, they'd already started the Super Bowl, so it was part of the NFL. But the Jets and Raiders were AFC rivals, old AFL rivals, and two of the best teams in the AFL. And when a game ran over in those days, you weren't guaranteed to stay in with the game. The network made a decision, is this game worth staying with? And if you were down by a couple of touchdowns and there were only a few minutes left and it could take a long time to play, the networks would cut away and go to the movie that was scheduled. So Heidi was scheduled to start at the end of this game. The game went long, and so they cut away from the final minutes of the game. And the Jets were up by, I think, 2 touchdowns at the time, so it seemed like a pretty safe bet. Well, the Raiders ended up winning by 11 points, 43-32. And so they made up a ridiculous number of points in a very few minutes. And that was the last time that a network cut away from a game like that. Now they stay with games till the bitter end. If they are scheduled, they run over. They cover the overtime, whether it's football, basketball, hockey. That's the way it works. And it's all because of the Heidi game. And, of course, the only thing Heidi has to do with that was that the movie Heidi was started, and they took off the ending of the Jets-Raiders game. Interesting. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about the Obama administration coming in and some of the decisions that have been made, and frankly, really, how the media is reacting to this. So conservative pundits and really talk show hosts are beside themselves. You know, when you make the case that the guy you may elect is a communist, and then we elect him, where do you go from there? What else can you say? Can you retract it and say, well, you're not really a communist, we'll be fine? Or do you have to double down and say it's going to be a disaster? Well, clearly the right-wing talk show hosts, whether they're on radio like Rush Limbaugh or the whole holy BS crowd on radio, holy being Hannity, O'Reilly, Limbaugh, and Ingram, and BS being BS, Bortz and Savage, but also O'Reilly on the Hannity on TV, you know, they just have no use for Obama, although they're trying to keep their powder dry for now because it's bad form if you start attacking a guy before he comes into office. But there are already people blaming this economic downturn on Obama, right? Which is interesting since he hasn't taken office or put any policies in place. But it's a psychological game, don't you know? In any case, first decision that Obama makes, besides that he's going to get a puppy, is to appoint Rahm Emanuel as his attack dog. No, as his chief of staff. And right away, from the right, people come out and say, oh, he's a real partisan. He's the most partisan person in the Democratic Party. I thought this was going to be a new day. I thought that we were going to get past partisanship. It's clear that Obama has taken on somebody with sharp elbows, so he doesn't mean the rhetoric that he spouted about working across the aisle. Well, saner heads prevailed than on talk radio. If you listen to people like Lindsey Graham, other Republicans on the Hill, they said, you know, Rahm Emanuel is a good choice because Rahm Emanuel doesn't get caught up in particularly partisan bickering, and he doesn't. He was head of the Democratic House Campaign Committee at one point, meaning his job was to get Democrats elected. So in that regard, he was partisan. But he reaches across the aisle. He works with people. He tries to get legislation passed. He knows how Capitol Hill works, and he knows how the White House works. So he's a great choice. He's also not a pushover. You cannot have someone in chief of staff that is going to be a pushover. You got to have somebody with sharp elbows. You have to have somebody that isn't going to get pushed around, but rather is going to put some pressure on people. And he can do that both in the White House among the Obama crew and on the Hill when they need votes. So everybody that's, you know, inside the Beltway on this basically admits it's a good idea. It's a smart move. It shows Obama's serious about getting some things done. And, of course, the right-wing talk show hosts are arguing, oh, it's so partisan. And I guess what I want to close with here is this whole notion that Obama somehow got a free ride from the media. You know, the complaints of media bias have been there for, well, most of my life. The Republicans have been whining about how they're treated in the media. When Nixon did it, we thought it was idiosyncratic. It was just him. But Republicans have been complaining about this, and conservatives have been complaining about this for decades. What they fail to realize is whether you're talking about the New York Times or NPR or the Washington Post or the networks, first and foremost, they deal in reality. So to the extent that the Republican Party is a party that has been denying a lot of science that's out there, and I'm not just talking about evolution or global warming. And again, there's a lot of intelligent Republicans that accept science as it is. I'm talking about the thousands of studies that get done every year on everything from cancer, cancer screening, cancer causes, environmental issues, surveys of what our fish population is in various parts of the ocean, to what the animal populations are, to the migration patterns, to whatever it is that we do science on, the right tends to poo-poo it. And, of course, a lot of good decisions are made on the basis of solid information. And you get solid information by doing empirical research. That means research in the real world. You may want the world to be a certain way, but saying so doesn't make it so. And that's where science comes in. And there are lines of literature in every conceivable domain of information gathering, from information about earthquakes that supports the theories of plate tectonics and earthquake prediction, to data about weather and climate and hurricanes that supports our ability to predict much better than we used to be able to the path of hurricanes, the severity of hurricanes, and get warnings out there. All kinds of things in terms of the number of animals we've got, whether we're hunting them or we're pulling them out of the ocean or whatever it is. We know when the populations are in danger now because we track a percentage of them. We know their migration patterns. We know when we're doing certain species harm. And if we want salmon to be around in 100 years, there's certain things you have to do. You can't overfish. You have to take care of some things. In general, Republicans don't come out against those things, but they're fairly anti-science. Not all Republicans, obviously, but a high enough percentage that their party's got a bad reputation, and the Bush administration in particular has ignored scientific evidence and the judgment of scientific panels and experts, consensus judgments by wide groups of people. They've ignored it. Not just on global warming, which I still hear right-wing talk show hosts out there claiming it's a total hoax. And that's what gets me, I guess, about the right, is how extreme their positions are. That is, it's not enough to say I disagree with the evidence on global warming, never mind that there's, you know, 10,000 studies in the literature, in various lines of literature, and 99% of them support the current model that people are working off of, and 1% of them don't. Never mind that. Let's just talk about the fact that they don't even cite the literature. They just say it's got to be bunk. And that it's a not just bunk, that it is a conspiracy, essentially. That it's a hoax and a conspiracy. Senator Inhofe says this. The right-wing talk show hosts say this, most of them. Well, a hoax means that everybody's in on it. And what they argue is, yes, the scientists, all these people are in on it. They want to get more money, and they want to enslave people to the idea that only government can solve this problem for you. All that rhetoric. That is people who, the nicest thing I can say about them is they think they're conservative. They're trying to be conservatives. But as soon as you put on those conservative lenses and view the world, you accept the idea that your position is right, and that therefore this other position must be wrong. So they take the evidence on global warming and they argue that it can't be right. So it must be a hoax. Therefore, these people are acting in bad faith. No, that's not how science works. But you can't quite explain it to them. So one of the bases for this media bias charge that Republicans have been trotting out every election and really every year for as long as I can remember is that the real media deals with reality, and they find that objectionable. I think Stephen Colbert said it best at the White House Correspondents' Dinner a few years ago when he was hosting. He said to President Bush, And he was criticized for skewing Bush too much this evening, but the best line that came out of it was, he said, I know, Mr. President, the pundits say that you should avoid, you should face the realities on the ground in Iraq. Don't do it, because as we all know, reality has a well-known liberal bias. And with that, that's going to do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. I'll be back next week, the 24th, and by then we should know what's happened in the Minnesota Senate race and a few other races. Remember, do it. Don't doubt it.